Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was Brian Brown, the Brown Briefly founder and master of mirth and merriment, who could always find a bright spot even on the darkest of days. And Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020, in the year of the tweet, and a global pandemic, now topped off with a new layer of social unrest not seen since the 1960s, certainly qualifies.
I think today, let me interrupt you for a minute. I think you have, do you have your phone on also? Because we're hearing an echo, so you need to shut one off, please.
Okay.
That's better. Thank you. Better? Got it.
Okay, very good. Thanks. So today in the Gene Boss studio, in the relative calm and security of downtown Vachon, we find mood-modulating synthesizer of voices from the virtual land of Zoom. Who needs an autopilot, airline captain, and steady-handed sound engineer, Truman O'Brien?
And Zoomologist. That's my new term, Zoomologist.
Awesome. True, are the airwaves and the brainwaves all getting along today?
Well, so far, we did a little bit of Peter, Paul, and Mary, so it was had a little bit of protest songs going there, but not a lot, so... We're trying to stay in with the mood here.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so next, let's recognize the new and improved steely-eyed vision of Lynn Kerrigan, poet par excellence, relocated from the land of magnolias to the island of Madrones, our analytic academic, social worker, backup singer, activist, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes. And Lynn, has successful cataract surgery allowed you to better keep your eye on the ball?
No, because I don't have very good short-term vision yet. I'm working on having to go get a temporary lens replacement for my first eyes glasses so that when the second one is done next week, I'll be able to see something. So it's more involved than I thought it would be. Not difficult, but logistically bizarre. I was thinking yesterday about going into Broadway Vision, which has a lab there at their optical shop, right, that I could go get 24-hour same-day lens. But no, am I driving up through that protest area? No, I am not. Yeah. So... oh my gosh, everything is happening at once. It feels like the decline of civilization, or at least my vision.
Well, it's interesting. It sounds like a work in progress, but progress being made, it sounds.
That's right. Step by step.
Yeah, this one other, let's see, on a non-social distancing day, we would normally find island historian, storyteller, international educator, and accomplished skipper Bruce Hallman, our stalwart guardian of the galaxy, settled comfortably between Truman and Lynn. But today, of course, Bruce is zooming in like the rest of us. So, Bruce, how's your day going so far?
It's going great. You know, beautiful mornings like this, in this time of self-isolation. Pam and I have breakfast in the hot tub every morning when we can, when it's not raining.
Nice.
Steamy.
And then I had an interesting, I was with Mike Kirk, who was the curator of the schools exhibit at the museum a couple of years ago. We're going over a talk he's going to do on the 19th. But he had some maps from the 1950s of the Vachon Bridge. And so we were talking about the what would have happened to Vachon had the bridge been built.
Oh, boy.
And then also talking about, which would have been a very different place. And then talking about his friend, Governor Rossellini, who just lives down the road, or lived down the road from where Mike lives. And Rosalini was the governor when the bridge failed by one, basically by one vote. And so Vashon was saved. So it's been a good morning.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Oh, I was just going to say that the one vote, that must have been one vote in the legislature?
Yes.
It was interesting.
Actually, it's a little complicated, but it was a tie vote in the Senate. And so it went to the president of the Senate, who was a lieutenant governor, John Sherberg, who had been a head football coach at UW and was lieutenant governor for like almost 30 years.
Oh, my God.
Sherberg actually sent the vote back to the bill back to a committee where it was known that it would die when it went back to the committee. Oh. So John Sherberg is the real guy who saved Vashon.
Right. Thank you for that. That was interesting.
Yeah.
Fantastic story and another perspective from history, which is so important today. Let's see, another welcome site on our Zoom screens. 3 weeks beyond pure gardening immersion is organic sound effects master, singer, thespian. Sorry, managing connections. Half a bubble shy of plum, but knows more ways to swing a hammer than most mortal men, is carpenter Michael Shook, a.k.a. Chauncey Gardner. Michael, your new maple trees must now be in full leaf, alternatively catching pearls of spring rain and rays of summer sun.
It's pretty wonderful out here. They're all doing good. I had to do a little root pruning on a couple. Those have recovered nicely, and I'm very excited about a 60-year-old weeping Japanese maple, the dissectum leaves. That a person on a Maury Island was giving away to whoever could dig it out. And I got it out last year. It was pretty nerve wracking because it was in such bad soil. I really thought, well, it's going to be a dried out twig come spring here. And I've been holding my breath, and it leafed out. The leaves are going strong. I think this baby made it. So it's gorgeous tree. I'm very thankful that they gave it away and that I was able to save it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I see here also we have Susan McCabe, a master of dialogue, political activist, observer of truth, arbiter of insight, and host of the important and discerning conversations we all really need to hear on Real Talk. And so, Susan, what are you bringing to our attention today at noon?
Boy, that's a fabulous introduction. Thank you, Kevin. I don't know how to keep up with that, but today we're talking about your gut health.
Oh,
so,
okay.
And we're going to find out what the term gutsy really means.
Awesome.
Dr. Lisa Morse is going to join me, and she is a naturopath here on the island who specializes in all things guts and how broadly your gut affects the rest of your health.
Huge.
Yeah.
It is mind-boggling.
It's like more than your brain.
Yeah. We all have to listen to this, guys.
You know, you said gut, and I had this sort of involuntary reaction. My gut spoke to me when you said that.
They call it the second brain, I will just say.
Yeah.
Although,
yeah. I would agree.
I thought the spine was the second brain. Hence making your gut the third brain.
No,
I have to disagree with that because
tune in.
Go ahead.
You'll see.
Okay. Lastly, yours truly, editor of Indivisible, Vashon's weekly publication, for your consideration and finding far too many ways to stay busy during our imposed stay home, stay safe regimen. I am Kevin Jones.
Hey, Kevin. Indeed.
Thank you so much. Let's see. You may have to bear with us, dear listener, because I'm finding that I normally call in on my phone, but my phone has like a 10-second audio delay, which would be very awkward. So I'm going to try to press on and hope my computer internet link stays stable as we talk about filling our time today. I think we'll have no difficulty reflecting on the social unrest that is now stretched from coast to coast, and even last Sunday invaded bucolic Bellevue. In just a few short days, George Floyd's death clearly exposes the intersection between American justice and leadership. I'd like to start today by listening to MSNBC commentator Ali Velshi. This is the morning after he was tear-gassed and hit by a rubber bullet while covering the growing unrest in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So let's just listen.
I think the senator had a lot of this wrong, and I think the governor has a lot of it wrong. The idea of focusing on whether they're agitators from outside and whether that this should be about George Floyd misses the point in American cities, and it misses the point in this city in particular. This is not a majority black city. In fact, the proportion of African Americans in this city is lower than on average. It's about 12.7% across the country. It's 8.7% in this city. It's a large immigrant population. The median income for black households here is $30,000, less than half of the median income for household ownership is greater than black household ownership by a bigger margin than most of America. Buying and owning a house in Minneapolis for African-American families is not actually a road to wealth like it is in most other places. So when you combine that with what the representative was just saying, what Congresswoman Omar was just saying about looking at what happened to George Floyd, what you look at is across the entire socioeconomic, legal, and political spectrum, blacks don't count in Minneapolis. So all this nonsense about focusing on George Floyd and this being about George Floyd and don't do these things that are destructive is nonsensical. And I was actually kind of surprised to hear it from the senator. This is institutional socioeconomic and injustice and racism. That's what's behind this. That's why people are prepared to come out and do damage to private property. And to suggest that it's out-of-staters and all that, it misses the fundamental point of what is wrong in Minneapolis and what is wrong in so many American cities. People in Phoenix were not protesting because of George Floyd. They were protesting because George Floyd is this week's symbol of the inequality that African Americans continue to face in this country, in this city, and that is, we need to remember both. You need to say his name. You need to say everybody else's name who died, and you need to remember that that list is so long because the underlying problem, as the congresswoman said, is not getting fixed.
So, I was really struck by some of Ali Velshi's words, blacks don't count, and that George Floyd is just this week's symbol of long-term oppression. So in the face of all of this, you know, it seems no coincidence that Vashon showing up for racial justice is writing postcards with Reclaim Our Vote to restore voting rights for those who are oppressed. On Vashon, you know, our current Senator Joe Wynn ran partly on a message that he would be the first person of color elected to the 34th Legislative District as a state senator. And he secured more votes than Shannon Braddock, a white woman. But interestingly, both were exceptionally qualified. They both emerged from a field 7-person strong that included 4 people of color and 5 women. So there's so many considerations for our vote. If you look at what Ali Velshi said about what's going on in the country from his perspective, the role of race and gender, how do they briefly see race and gender as factors influencing our selection of leaders, particularly given this generations-long suppression that we now see in full view?
Well, I would hope that I'm going to vote for the person who's best qualified. I'm seeing when I look at the ballot an increasing number of women and people of color, you know, Hispanic or African American running for office. So I would have to say, all things given, equality there in terms of qualifications. I mean, if I have candidate A who is a white male and he's very well qualified, okay, and I have candidate B who is a Hispanic male who's very well qualified, just as qualified, I'm going to vote for the Hispanic male, or if that's an African-American woman, I'm going to vote or a woman run because it's humans are humans. Power corrupts us all. It's, you know, African Americans aren't any more perfect than white people, but we've got to get a more equal representation. I just don't see change happening until we've got a greater representation that actually reflects the people in our country.
Well, there's the classic studies of women's leadership, and it applies across the board. It's called the 30% rule. Okay, anytime any kind of legislative body, corporate board, or anything, once 30% of the members of that organization or board are women or minorities, the nature of the decision process changes.
There you go.
So it's well documented, and it's been supported by numerous studies. And so it's clear that what we need is the leadership to reflect who the people are.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And I think it goes even a step further. What we are battling is not institutional racism. It is white supremacy. And when we say who is qualified, even the qualifications that we list have to change, because those qualifications, whether we state them aloud or not, have been male, legally educated or educated in the law or educated at an Ivy League school.
Harvard Business School.
Right. Having held business, corporate business positions. Corporations are based on military rule. All of that is so deep and endemic and speaks to white supremacy that we need to look at qualifications like, do you understand the lived experiences of people of color? That to me is a qualification. Do you understand the lived experiences of women? That to me is a qualification. I don't care if you got a law degree from Harvard. I do care if you've been a judge and you've been a judge who has perhaps meted out true justice. So I think we need to look at qualifications beyond those that perpetuate white supremacy. Lynn?
Thank you, Susan. I think what you're saying is really important. I would add two more things in that. One is that I don't think that we can divorce institutional racism from white supremacy. I think they are one and the same thing. One is individual and one is the systems that we've created about that. So they go together hand in hand. And I think the other thing is that it's pretty hard to prove whatever it is people understand. What I look at is their policies and their actions and their actual drive towards trying to make change or try to support people of color as allies. I agree with you, man, that we need to have our qualifications for office to be more representative of the people in the U.S. I kind of defer my vote, if all things are equal, to trying to get more women in office. Mm-hmm. So while I agree with that still and support that, I may not have always linked up how much more we need to represent or have represented people of color. You know, I think we all need to be more proportional in our demographics, in our legislative, representation.
So I have to completely agree that this is a goal that we should aspire to. But I would argue that that is not the goal that is aspired to nationally. I think that people tend to vote for the people that look like them.
Yep.
Yeah. And, I agree.
And although this is a great goal, it's not happening. And I it's going to take a lot of education and a lot of change to bring that about. When I was listening to Michael, I thought, boy, Michael, that is very admirable, but it is certainly not difficult, I don't think.
And you've got to remember, I mean, Lynn Cheney, Phyllis Schlafly are women.
You bet.
Yep.
Sort of like, you know, Thatcher. You want them representing you in a legislature.
Yep.
You know, so, you know, just being a woman or just being a person of color doesn't transcend progressive attitudes.
That's right. And not just attitudes, but the willingness to promote policies and legal change.
Stick
your neck out. Because what I'm learning is that, you know, it's hard enough to rethink your attitudes and years of history and years of debate about this. It's another step to really get behind people who are looking at, for example, the issues around police brutality. You know, in Seattle, I think we have started looking at some changes in policy from going from the did he have malice aforethought? That is a very hard thing to prove. And now they're changing the definition of what is unreasonable to what I think it's what the average person would think was unreasonable use of force. So it's shifting slightly from being able to prove that person's inner feelings to how does the community view these things to a more broad topic of what would a reasonable person do. I don't know that that's way better, but it's stepping aside from some individual state of mind.
And I definitely think we should focus on some, you know, your local events of what's happening also over this time period. I just wanted to say that this, what I heard in Ali Velchi's words are this steady multi-generational drumbeat of oppression, which just hits a breaking point and the entire system explodes. And how have we been so aware of this since the last time this occurred in the mid-60s, and we still have the systems that go back to the same place that we really were back then. So perhaps the leadership and the decision makers fundamentally needs to change, right, to move us forward. But given that thing you mentioned, Lynn, you know, we've seen plenty of attention about Minnesota, but, you know, closer to home, protests in Seattle just ongoing for multiple days. Of course, what happened is we had curfews established in Seattle by Mayor Durkin. Governor Inslee activated 200 unarmed National Guard troops into Seattle. So what do we think about how our local politicians and law enforcement did regarding this racial equity front and responding to the protests?
You know, I have to be a little defensive of Jenny Durkin and Jay Inslee, because I do think their hearts are in the right place. I do think, and I heard them say frequently in their press conferences, that they are with the protesters. They're torn between supporting the protesters and dealing with the violence, and it's a tough spot to be in.
Yeah, I think that they did a nice job saying there were at least two groups of people in the streets. One are the people who were showing up to grieve and protest this terrible history of misuse of race in profiling and in arresting people and in use of force. There is documentation of that everywhere. And there is some documentation that otherwise people are coming in from out of state and from the anarchist little hotbeds using the protests to foment craziness for whatever reason, and it takes the gravitas from the protesters' movement. You know, I think they have every right. I totally support them to be in the streets and protest. If I were in Seattle right now, I'd be out there marching with them in solidarity. But I think that the attempts of outside agitating groups to foment looting and property damage and all of that just takes away from the peaceful message, and it makes it look really bad if our police and our governor doesn't stem violence.
Did you happen to see the police chief in Bellevue?
And I did.
Now, that guy had it together. He met with them. He said, we hear you. You know, we're with you. We're going to work with you however we can. But did you also see that there was about 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 punks, thugs, that broke into the Bellevue, whatever it is, and, you know, was wrecking stuff? Those are two different groups. They are not the exactly. same people at all.
Yeah.
At all.
And in part, I mean, my sense is both Inslee and Durkin, they were too slow to react, just like they were to the COVID. I mean, this happened before with the World Trade Organization in Seattle.
Yes,
I mean,
it did.
You know, they had almost, 3 or 4 days to get prepared, because what happened in Minnesota was going to happen in cities around the country. And they were just, you know, and leaders are slow to react to those kind of things because they don't want to overreact. But at the same time, slow reaction, just like slow reaction to COVID, leads to these kinds of disasters. And it's sort of, you need leadership who's willing to act decisively, you know, within the law. I mean, you know, you don't want to go down Trump's road.
Police,
you
know, state.
Yeah.
Everybody But the reality is you've got legitimate protests going on, but you've got infused within it illegitimate actors. And you need to break those two out.
And I'm happy so far the violence, at least as far as I know, hasn't cost human life. But, you know, we say it's a disaster when they destroy property. And we're talking about the destruction of human life. The protest is against the destruction of human life. Trevor Howard had a great 20-minute treatise on the whole George Floyd situation. And one of the things he said was along the lines of civil society and civility are part of a contract we citizens make with our government. And when that contract is broken by those who are supposed to protect us, why should the citizens keep their side of the contract? Why should we protect property, which is apparently sacred in our capitalist society, much more sacred than human life?
I agree, Susan. I think that was well said. I have nothing more to say to it other than to amplify it and say I really agree with that dilemma. If I could add one quick thing, I sent to everyone on our team kind of a book report that was in the New Yorker last issue, May 25th. It was about a book called The Broken Heart of America by Walter Johnson, who is a Harvard historian with a background in slavery research. So it was a really radical article about this book, The Broken Heart of America, because he is stitching together the idea that we have not been able to solve these dilemmas because our system of capitalism is so tied up in our racial disparities and in the notions of white supremacy, and that it's all of a piece, and that we really need to look at how our system has codified issues around housing, around education, you know, that our whole system is designed to keep Black people in their place. And that's just criminal to me, you know, so many years later.
And I also think class comes into this. The working class back in the 19th century, when they started trying to organize unions, many of them were horribly beaten, murdered by federal troops. That went on clear on into the 20s and 30s. And I think what we're seeing is just a continuation of that had been going on for a long time. And we're seeing just an ongoing continuation of that. Like what you're saying there, Lynn, that and Susan, it's built into the system where I remember reading how struck I was reading Eric Fromm years ago when he writing in the early 50s when he said capital, that which is dead, commands labor, that which is alive. And for an economic system to work, these are issues that have to be decided upon, but they don't need to be decided upon at the expense of the humans who live within that system. And that's what we've decided to do. So, Susan, what you were saying, everyone's up, oh my gosh, the destruction of property. There's more people, I think, sometimes in some circles that are more angry about that than a man who was murdered.
Murdered in front of all of our faces.
Well, yeah, just to see, I did not look at any videos. I can't do that. Mm-hmm. But when the Seattle Times published just a picture, and just the picture of the police officer looking off, I don't know what, in the distance. It was horrifying.
Gut-wrenching, yes.
You know, it's such an underlying theme of these last several days is that the protesters, the peaceful protesters, the people trying to raise their voices about this inequity and the catalyst of this death, you know, their theme is being hijacked, right, by those who seek destruction. For example, in the Seattle Times, they were saying there seemed to be at least two protests going on. One taking the stage at Westlake was purposefully nonviolent. Quoted from one of the organizers, "We must not allow some white folks who think it's the way to do things to disrupt real change," referring to people he believed were set on violence. "Don't let anyone change us from our narrative," he went on to say. But nearby, other protesters were more aggressive, according to the Times, confronting officers, throwing water bottles and fireworks. Flames and black smoke rose from a police car, as well as other vehicles. So the message is important. Many have returned to it. But what do we think protesters might do so that we can really keep that message from being lost? What, any ideas?
But for one thing, I beg to differ with the term protester, because that second group are not protesters. That had nothing to do with protest. That had to do with, I don't know what, anarchy. Or
I agree,
whatever.
Truman, anarchy.
The fun of chaos.
Exactly. That is not protest. And I absolutely don't subscribe to any of that.
And I did hear the protest leaders, really the peaceful demonstrators, saying that any violence is not condoned by us. That is not what we're here to do. The family of George Floyd actually asked that people not get violent. So I think they were trying to ensure that we understood they were a peaceful group. But maybe the only other thing that could be done, what I think about, Bruce, is your comment about, you know, if the police had been prepared to arrest anybody or detain them that was causing violence early on, without seeming to, you know, tear gas the whole of everyone, you know, that maybe that's some contract they can make with peaceful demonstrators. Well, that anyone fomenting violence, you know, will be detained.
Well, you know, I mean, if you look at any of the planned protest marches or any of those things, if they work with police, if they work with the the local officials, it works out great. You know, you've got your route that you're going to use, go use it. If you want to put 100,000 people in the streets, put them in the streets, but do it in such a way that, you know, you can keep track of all of them and not have that craziness going on.
It's kind of a dual responsibility.
Absolutely. I mean,
protesters have a responsibility to call out and identify those people who are not legitimate.
Absolutely.
Protesters. Mm-hmm. And the police have a responsibility to react to legitimate protesters in peaceful and cooperative ways.
Absolutely.
To go after those who are bent on destruction and not legitimate protesters.
Absolutely.
And so it's a cooperative effort. And what has happened is that's hardly ever worked. Mm-hmm.
If I can step back one second to George Floyd, the thing that I think is so bound up in his murder is that the Chauvin, the policeman who leaned on his neck for so long, had like 17 complaints against him. And I think that there is a responsibility on the police's part to take complaints, especially around use of force, more seriously. I understand that policing is a terribly difficult job and involving a lot of danger and a lot of judgment all the time. But on the other hand, if someone has a propensity to violence, I think that needs to be taken seriously within the department. It's not us against the police. It's us against bad actors on the streets and bad actors in the police.
So I love who there was one of the black comedians. I'm sorry, I can't remember who said, you know, you can't have a bad apple in the. What if American Airlines had one bad apple, one pilot? Most of those pilots are really good, but occasionally you get one that, you know, runs into a building, you know, or a mountain. It's just not acceptable to have one of those guys, right? It isn't in the police department as well.
And this speaks to some things that I was reading about how we train police in this country. And I think this is one of the things that we've been hearing about for decades, especially from the populations of people of color who are three times more likely to be questioned in certain ways in certain situations. And I was reading something else, is 7 to 9 times more likely to be shot in a traffic pullover thing, in a routine traffic stop. And I looked up some things about our training here. And in most instances, police training, 86%, I think, of people who go through the police academies attend academies that are set up on a military model, where you've got a drill instructor and it's, you know, in your face all the time and aggressive, intense, extraordinarily stressful form of training. And then they have a certain amount of time that is educational and law enforcement tactics and things like that. But then there's an enormous amount of time, hundreds of hours spent on firearm training, use of force. There's a wonderful YouTube thing from about 6 years ago in England, where a big man with a machete, who's obviously deeply disturbed, is swinging it in his street and trying to chop at the UK, at the British police officers. And they keep moving around and staying out of his way and talking to him, trying to talk him down. Meanwhile, somebody else had radioed for reinforcements. And it took him about 5-10 minutes of doing this, and it was difficult. But when the reinforcements arrived, they had huge plexiglass riot shields, and they got him out into the street again, and then they just closed ranks around him with the plexiglass shields, and he couldn't do any damage to anyone. They disarmed him, they handcuffed him, they took him to a psychiatric hospital under safe conditions to be evaluated. That guy would have been told twice to drop the machete in any city in America, city. And then they would have put about 30 bullets in him.
Yeah.
Hey,
Susan had a comment, I think. Maybe not Susan. I don't know if you wanted to say anything.
Oh, well, I'm not sure it's totally related, but I think that example that you gave, the UK versus the US, Michael, just shows the underlying philosophy of domination that our culture lives on. And Trump once again exemplified that yesterday by telling the governors they must dominate the protesters. That was right after he had a conversation with his buddy Putin.
Yeah.
So, hey, folks, if you don't think he wants to be a dictator, think again.
That was exactly, Susan, where my mind was going, is about the idea that, you know, the people who are protesting the with great sorrow, the loss of, you know, Windows and Macy's or wherever, and are calling for law and order, as we have had several cycles in this country of law and order presidents who seem to think that the way to get elected is to crack down on members of our community that they hold in lesser regard. And I was listening to those calls for, you know, greater order on the streets, and Trump's ridiculous holding up a Bible, having just cleared an entire section of Washington, D.C. so that he could go and do that. This law and order revival that has come about in Trump is just another mechanism for using force when we want to, without thinking that Black people are actually part of our community.
Right.
And it's no wonder they were being sort of, you know, encouraged to protest, encouraged to gather peacefully, and trying to hear them, if not change things. But I don't think that message gets through to a lot of people about Blacks being part of the community. So why would we not, you know, go and arrest them in masses? I just think it's all gotten very convoluted and pathetic.
Certainly, it's disturbing to see the chain of events that happened only yesterday with the dominate discussion, the using tear gas police mounted on horses in some cases to disperse peaceful protesters for the case of a photo op, and also the president's statement that, you know, we will come in and clean things up right away. It will solve the problem quickly, I believe, is what one of his tweets said. And what that tells me is the president's problem that he's trying to solve is the expression of democracy in America.
Yes.
And as you said, Susan, I think those trend lines are very clear. I wonder, however, maybe our last question is, we're 5 months away from the election in November. That is forecast to be even uglier than what we experienced in 2016. Now we have national outrage that's gone on for, I think, 6 days now in a row. Is there any hope that that national outrage is going to curb the tendencies of our current administration? Or do we think this rhetoric is just going to escalate all the way through the summer and the fall?
Escalate, definitely.
Oh, I think Trump will escalate it, perhaps to his own disadvantage.
My worry is that he will use this to declare martial law,
yep,
and to interfere with the elections.
Yep.
Yes.
And I think we need to speak out against that. Those of you readers who can, please talk to your congressman and your mayor, and let's talk about that.
Somehow we need to regain the balance of powers in our supposed democratic structure. Somehow our congressional leaders, whether they be in the House or both of them in the Senate, need to really wrestle down the executive and the judicial branch right now.
I agree.
Before
I'm
November.
Sure Mitch McConnell will get right on that.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Another couple hundred justices installed.
So what I'd like to say to our dear listener, and of course to ourselves as well, is you know, we have opportunities to speak out. We have opportunities to talk about what country we want to live in and what that country should look like, and whether that's writing a letter to the editor, whether that's putting something on social media, whether that's just talking to crazy Uncle Floyd right, about how we're reacting to all this. We all have that within our power, but I think it's important that we speak up now, because we have 5 months to shape the narrative between now and when everybody raises their voice to make that decision in November.
Absolutely.
Right on.
See you all next week.